There are few really, truly great stock ticker symbols in this world, but Harley Davidson has one of them. Tough day, though, for HOG in the markets and in the global economy. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rosendahl. It is Monday, today the 25th day of June. Good as always to have you along, everybody. A kind of remarkable thing happened in this economy today. Harley Davidson, a company which less than a month into his administration, President Trump invited to the White House, said this of the bottom line impact of the president's tariffs and European retaliation. Quote, Harley Davidson believes the tremendous cost increase if passed on to its dealers and retail customers would have an immediate and lasting detrimental impact to its business. End of quote. So instead of raising prices for its European customers, $2,200, the company said, in essence, we are going to take that chunk of our motorcycles and make them someplace else. Marketplace's Andy Euler goes from specific company to the much broader tariff fallout to get us going.
It's not baseball or apple pie, but when it comes to made in the USA brand identity,
Harley sells Americana.
James Hardiman is an analyst at Wedbush Securities. He says Harley's been struggling to sell to an aging American market. U.S. retail sales were down 12% over last year. The company also closed a plant in Kansas City, eliminating 260 American jobs this year, and it's taken some heat for that.
The penalty of them outsourcing was always significantly greater than most companies.
But manufacturing overseas will make Harley more competitive in the European and Asian markets. Gleb Mitko is a global industry analyst with the Fredonia Group. He says establishing a factory in somewhere like Thailand makes a lot of sense for Harley.
One of the advantages that Thailand offers is that it's in an area with a lot of high growth markets, Southeast Asia. And in a lot of ways, Thailand is an automotive manufacturing hub today.
And a plant there would allow Harley to avoid steel and aluminum tariffs and the 31% retaliatory tariffs imposed by the Europeans on their bikes. Chad Bown at the Peterson Institute for International Economics says if Harley's thinking about outsourcing because of tariffs and rising input costs, many other American companies are probably thinking the same thing.
I think this is the first of many, many examples that we're going to see of this. Companies realizing that in order to access Europe or China, they're going to have to move their production to those countries.
For its part, Harley Davidson said costs related to tariffs will be more than $40 million for the rest of this year and between $90 and $100 million every year after that. I'm Andy Euler for Marketplace.
You know how we say all the time on this program that this is a global economy? Harley has definitely been playing in it. If you want to see where and how many people have been buying Harleys all over the world the past decade or so, go to our Instagram. We are at Marketplace APM. Check it out. It's a cool little graphic. You know, Harley Davidson is not the only Wisconsin company that is trying to make it in this new era of Trump tariffs. Cheese, long a staple of the Wisconsin economy, is having a tough time as well. Mexico is just one example, is slapping retaliatory tariffs on American cheese imports in the 20 to 25% range, which has cheesemakers alarmed because Mexico is the biggest market for U.S. cheese exports. Anna Swanson covers global trade for the New York Times. She is also here on Fridays every now and then as well to wrap things up with us. She is back from Wisconsin not too long ago. Anna, thanks for coming on.
Thanks for having me.
And not even on a Friday.
That's right.
I love this piece. Dateline Plymouth, Wisconsin. The very first line is, it's a common observation that you can't turn off the cows, not for Christmas and not for a trade war.
That's the word I was hearing in Wisconsin. I went there to check out cheese exports, and it turns out that cheesemakers there and dairy farmers are really hit by a lot of different forces that are going on in trade right now, a lot of different cross currents that are affecting their industry.
So let's get to the Sartori Cheese Company. Jeff Schwager is the president. And what's happened? This is my favorite example in this whole piece. So there are rules for what you can call a cheese, right? Parmesan has to be made in Parma. Asiago has to be made in Asiago, right? And the Europeans are negotiating these agreements with, say, the Mexicans, a huge export market for American cheese. And so now poor Jeff Schwager, the guy who runs Sartori, has to market something called Sartoriago in Mexico. What even is that?
Right, right. So it's all kind of confusing. But if you think of the example of champagne is one that's familiar to people, right? That champagne has to come from France. If it comes from Spain, it's called cava, right? So for cheeses, the Europeans are fighting for these same protections. They want Parmesan to be something that's from the area of Parma, Italy. And they argue that this is just, you know, their version of intellectual property. And as the Europeans have signed new free trade deals around the globe, American cheesemakers are gradually getting blocked out of using these names.
They also, there's this thing that happens with economic policy, right? Unintended consequences, because people behave in ways that perhaps the policymakers didn't expect. And I wonder if this is sort of an intended, unintended consequence, right? Because some of this, all of this really, was pretty much predictable, and yet now policymakers are saying, whoa, hey, what? I mean, you look at the Harley-Davidson news of today.
That's right. So Wisconsin is being hit in a number of ways, right? It's not just the cheesemakers. Other Wisconsin industries like cranberries, apples, ginseng are all facing tariffs. And a lot of that actually is because the state is represented by House Speaker Paul Ryan, right? Mm-hmm. So other countries think that he might be influential and that if they kind of hurt his constituents, he might do something to answer back to the Trump trade agenda. But yeah, I think a lot of this was predictable. I mean, especially farmers have seen these threats coming for a while and have tried to bring it to politicians' attention.
But then you read all the way down to the bottom of this article, which obviously I encourage everybody to do, but you quote a dairy farmer in Wisconsin saying, sometimes you have to suffer a little bit to get what you want, you know, and that's what he's looking for.
Yeah, so the president does still have a really strong base of support in Wisconsin. I mean, obviously, it was one of the places that helped him win the election. And there's also this other battle that the United States is having with Canada over dairy. Right. And if you remember a few weeks back when the president went to the G7, he was really sparring with the Canadian Prime Minister, Justin Trudeau.
Escaped my memory.
Right. So the Canadians, became our biggest trade enemies there for a couple days. But it is a big deal in Wisconsin. You know, they do think about these Canadian tariffs. So when the president spoke out like that, definitely some dairy farmers there saw him as defending them against the Canadians. However, there are, you know, many other fronts in the trade war besides Canada right now.
Many, many. Anna Swanson covers global trade for the New York Times, writing this past weekend on cheese. Anna, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
There was a little bit of confusion in the Trump administration today about another slice of its trade policy, China this time. There have been published reports that the White House is going to announce new restrictions on Chinese investment in American technology companies later this week. Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin said this morning it's not going to be just China. The restrictions are going to apply to everybody. And then Chief Trade Advisor Peter Navarro went on CNBC this afternoon and said, no, it's going to be just China. Whichever way the wind blows, if it happens, it's going to be a big deal. Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
This has been coming for a while. Last month, an official statement from the White House said the U.S. would implement investment restrictions and export controls for, quote, Chinese persons and entities related to the acquisition of industrially significant technology. But today, Secretary Mnuchin appeared to walk back the focus on China. David Dollar, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution's China Center, says that may be wise.
It's a generally good practice in writing laws or making regulations not to single out individual countries, but to single out bad behaviors.
The U.S. government has accused other countries of trying to steal technology. Adam Siegel directs the Digital and Cyberspace Policy Program at the Council on Foreign Relations.
France, Israel, South Korea have all been named, but the economic threat is certainly much bigger from China than from any of those other players.
And Siegel says Beijing will see the move as directed at China and could retaliate. Jennifer Harris is a fellow at the Roosevelt Institute. She's not surprised that different officials in the Trump administration have different takes on the new policy.
This is obviously overturning 40 years or so of economic orthodoxy that argued for a U.S. open door to investment, and old habits die hard, especially in Washington.
Officials have until week's end to work out those differences. That's when an announcement is expected from the White House. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, no thank you very much. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Content, as you know, is king. If there's one thing that is certain in this digital economy, it is that. Consider for a moment, then, the man Keech Hagee, a reporter for the Wall Street Journal, calls in her new book, The King of Content. The man in question is Sumner Redstone, the nonagenarian magnate who controls CBS and Viacom. And despite what Redstone likes to say, he is not going to live forever. And what happens to those two not small content companies he is the king of is kind of an issue. Keech Hagee, welcome to the program.
Great to be here.
This is a tricky way to start a radio interview, but I need you to do a little org chart for me here. National Amusements, CBS, and Viacom, the three sort of legs of the Redstone empire. Could you explain how they relate to each other?
Sure. National Amusements is the family holding company that the Redstones control. It was a drive-in theater company that is still a movie theater company today. It just happens to also own the controlling stock of Viacom and CBS, two rather large public media companies.
Got it. That totally makes sense. Now, let me back you up a little bit and point this out and then get your reaction. You say somewhere in this book that Sumner Redstone, or you point out, I suppose, that Sumner Redstone was like 63-ish or something before he, in his own words, became like a media mogul, I guess, right? I mean, he had a long and fruitful career before he got into this business.
Right. He was a movie chain executive for an entire career. He could have easily retired and played golf, and that could have been it.
Except he decides at the ripe old age of 63 that he wants to do something else. Give us the origin story of how National Amusements became, as you pointed out, this thing that owns CBS and Viacom.
So Sumner Redstone was a very successful regional theater chain owner who had sort of a national profile, and he had a little side hobby of investing in movie studios. So in the late 70s and early 80s, he started making a bunch of those bets, invested in Fox, things like that, and did really well, scary well. And he got a bunch of money, and he started to look around at what else he could invest in and saw this rather new company called Viacom, which had been spun off from CBS in the 70s. And at first, he started just dabbling to do a little investing, and at some point in the process decided he wanted to take the whole thing over, and he did.
So here we have a man who is like 90-something now, right? How old is he?
95.
He's 95. He has not been heard to speak, I think, in public in 4 or 5 years. One doesn't really know what state of mind he's in, right? And yet here we are talking about him.
We're talking about him a lot because he made kind of a mess of his succession planning, frankly. It's incredible. Sumner Redstone always claimed that he was never going to die.
That's right.
And it seems like it might be true. He would proudly say that kind of as a joke to reporters for years. I'm never going to die. I'm going to control this even from beyond the grave. I don't have to do any succession planning because I'm never going to die. Ha ha. Except that he kind of meant it. And he thought that he was going to lawyer his way beyond the afterlife and decide how his companies were going to be run. And he did a really bad job of that, in part because he probably didn't give it all directly to his family in the way he should have. And that mess of the last 3 years that we've seen is a result of that.
Well, so talk to me for a second about his family and succession plans. And there are lawsuits and takeover bids, and his daughter, Sherry Redstone, is now nominally in control of this company. What is the current state of play?
The current state of play is that Sherry Redstone is in control of her father's media empire. Many people close to him say that is something that he didn't want. And there is a big legal fight stretching before us over this summer about how she has chosen to use that control and whether she's going to retain it.
Is she going to be... Well, let me back up. One of the hallmarks of Sumner Redstone as an owner and tycoon is pitting various subordinates against each other. He's a volatile guy himself. He's got a temper. You know, I mean, Crotchety is being extremely kind. What will she be like running this company, given now the way media conglomerates are growing in this economy?
Well, Sherry Redstone has kept her cards pretty close to the vest. She's different than her father in that she listens a lot more. She seeks more counsel. She's much more behind the scenes. You know, Sumner used to love to call up reporters and give them an earful, and they loved him as a result. He was great fun to cover in the 80s and 90s. Sherry is not like that at all. But as we've seen through her attempts to merge CBS and Viacom, she is not retiring. She is actively trying to shape the fates of these media companies. And what she sees is a field of rapid consolidation where you better get bigger or you're in big trouble.
Kei Chagi is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal. Her most recent book is called The King of Content, about Sumner Redstone, a totally, totally fascinating character. Keech, thanks a lot. Appreciate your time.
Thank you.
We had a much younger, relatively speaking, Sumner Redstone on the program back in 2006, me and him in his living room at the time. We're going to put the whole thing online today for you to hear. It's at marketplace.org. Coming up,
we've seen demos of robot concierge, room service delivery, bartenders.
It's going to be tough to organize that robot labor, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the Wawa's, you knew it was coming. The Dow Industrial's down 328 today, down about 500 at 1.1 1/3%, closed to 24,252. Tariff trade wars, stop me if you've heard this before. NASDAQ off 160 points, 2%, 75-32. The S&P 500 down 37 1/3%, 27.17. Harley Davidson, the hog of the open HOG, skidded down 5.9% today. Yamaha Motor Company dropped 2 1/10%. Tech took a dive in anticipation of those curbs on foreign investment we mentioned earlier. Intel down 3 4/10%. AMD, Advanced Micro Devices, disconnected 4 1/3% today. Bond prices rose. Yield on the 10-year Treasury note fell to 2.88%. You're listening to Marketplace. Anne in Stamford, Connecticut, wrote to say that Marketplace and Make Me Smart help her contextualize so much of what is happening in the world right now in a way that is approachable and entertaining. Anne, thanks for being a friend to Marketplace and for supporting our work. To join her as a Marketplace investor, donate online at marketplace.org. And thanks to everybody who contributes to keep public service journalism strong. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. We're in the closing stretch of the Supreme Court's term, just another couple of days and some big decisions left to come. One in particular that we are keeping an eye on here, a case called Janus v. AFSCME. That's the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees, the biggest public sector workers union in this country. At issue is whether government workers who get the benefits of a collective bargaining agreement can be forced to pay some part of the union dues. Organized labor is wary about what a ruling against them might mean, but as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports, some private sector workers do still choose to pay union dues, even when they don't have to.
Unions represent just over 10% of the U.S. workforce, down by half since the early 1980s. Organized labor is now strongest in the public sector, where about 1 in 3 teachers, firefighters, DMV workers, and the like are union members. A defeat for organized labor in the Janus case would ban public sector unions nationwide from collecting so-called agency or fair share fees from non-union members, which is actually the same limitation that most public and private sector unions already face in the 28 states with so-called right-to-work laws. And that includes Nevada. Although, as unions' power has declined nationwide, they've pretty much maintained their strength in Nevada, says Ruben Garcia, who teaches labor law at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Here in Nevada, even though we are nominally right to work, we have a very strong labor movement in the private sector because of the hospitality industry.
Nearly 13% of Nevada workers are union members. The percentage actually ticked up last year. Garcia chalks it up to Las Vegas's massive hotel and casino industry and smart strategy by local unions. These service jobs can't easily be outsourced abroad, and they're crucial to visitors feeling well taken care of, so they'll gamble and spend. That's not going to happen if customers have to cross a picket line to get in the door.
The dependence that the industry has on workers, particularly on the Strip, has given them a significant bargaining advantage.
The Culinary Union is one of several powerful hospitality unions based in Las Vegas, with nearly 60,000 members, many of them women and immigrants. Despite Nevada's right-to-work law, the union says more than 90% of culinary workers covered by a collective bargaining agreement voluntarily choose to join, including Annette Wright DeCampos, who's worked at the Golden Nugget for more than 30 years.
I started out in room service. I was young, petite, pretty. It was great tips at that time.
She moved up to work banquets and now makes $20 an hour plus benefits. Wright DeCampos has worked non-union. Between high school and college, she had a minimum wage job at a KFC.
And my grandmother, she was one of the founders of the Culinary Union, and she came in and grabbed me. She said, nope, you're starting your family. You need health care that's affordable to you. You need a future with a pension.
Bethany Kahn is spokeswoman for the Culinary Union, which has been negotiating new five-year contracts with Caesars, MGM, and other major casino companies. Kahn says the union is keeping close watch on economic changes that could threaten wages and job security, like replacing hospitality workers with hospitality robots.
We've seen demos of robot concierge, room service delivery, bartenders. We are tackling automation and technology in this contract, retraining opportunities, a severance if there are layoffs, but a goal was to retain workers.
Brian Storia is a bartender at the Hard Rock Hotel. It's non-union, which is fine with Storia. He isn't thrilled with union rules or paying union dues. Still, he thinks he does better because of the strong contracts hospitality unions have negotiated up and down the strip.
The major casinos, I think they have to have a competitive wage and a benefits package.
Bethany Kahn says the Culinary Union lost members in the Great Recession from layoffs on the strip. Now, the union's building back up and trying to expand its reach. More than 3,000 culinary and bartending workers recently voted to unionize at Station Casinos, one of the state's biggest private employers. The company's been fighting that union drive. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
The thing about the financial crisis and the 10 years since is that it hit people differently depending on where they were in their lives. Case in point, from our first-person series on the crisis called How We Changed, Christy Frazier from Chicago, Illinois, and this story about her sister Elizabeth.
My sister and I grew up in Wisconsin. We both got into drugs in high school. We both got in trouble for petty crime. We both liked the wrong boys, but somehow everything always ended up worse for her. In 2008, I was in graduate school. Elizabeth had been in and out of jail. She had gone through rehab. She had gotten her life back on track. She had gotten engaged, and she was working at a nonprofit. And both her and her fiancé lost their jobs, and she couldn't find another one. She started becoming very stressed, very anxious. She started having stomach issues. She started having low back pain. That resulted in a surgery. And after she had the surgery, her pain didn't get better. She had beaten an opioid addiction in her 20s. And now she's prescribed opioids to treat her. Elizabeth didn't want to be on opioids. She wanted to wean herself off of these drugs. She started on a methadone program, and one morning she accidentally took too much, and she took a nap on her friend's couch, and she didn't wake up. After she passed away, we were going through some of her things, and we found this little prayer box, and all of her prayers in this little prayer box were about money. You know, money to be able to pay for this, money to pay this debt off. The last thing was money to help other people. Two paths. You know, mine is one of being fortunate enough to get an education, to be able to find work, to support myself. And Elizabeth's one of not having those things. This is about survival. It's about surviving and after the collapse.
Christy Frazier, Chicago, Illinois, talking about her little sister, Elizabeth. We've got pictures of both of them at our Instagram. We're at Marketplace APM. And while you're there, take a second, would you? Let us know how the financial crisis changed you. The hashtag we're using is How We Changed. This final note on the way out today, in which I gladly surrender this space to my predecessor, one David Brancaccio. You can hear him now on the Marketplace Morning Report, but a clip from this program that aired on June the 21st, 2000.
Okay, repeat after me the word potato four times fast. Mm-hmm. Now, do it like the actor James Coburn. Potato, 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 potato. There. I've just taught you how to do a mean impression of a Harley-Davidson motorcycle with a V-twin engine at idle. Harley-Davidson of Milwaukee has now abandoned its six-year effort to defend its trademark protection for that sound. A Harley representative is quoted as saying the company is tired of the cost of litigation. The company was awarded a trademark, but rivals Honda and Yamaha challenged it, saying they also make big bikes that make that sound.
Tough day for Harley, but great, right? Potato, potato, potato. I love that one. All these years later, Wall Street Today, forget about it. Daily production team on this program includes Bridget Bonner, Maria Hollenhorst, Sean McHenry, and Daisy Palacios. Our special projects desk is Tommy Andres and Haley Hirschman. Caitlin Esch is the producer on our wealth and poverty desk. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.